You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
So my guest today is Emily P. Freeman, who's the Wall Street Journal bestselling author of 6 books. With a master's degree in spiritual formation and leadership from Friends University, her most important work is to help create soul space and offer spiritual companionship and discernment for anyone struggling with decision fatigue. Emily has been a featured speaker for the Anglican Mission in the Americas, Faith and Culture Writers Conference, and the Apprentice Gathering. Her writing has been featured in Today's Parents, Christianity Today, and Patheos. Her nationally ranked podcast, The Next Right Thing, has more than 25 million downloads, and she regularly offers perspective and clarity through her weekly newsletter, The Soul Minimalist. She's got a brand new book. This is the one we talk about. It's called How to Walk into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. Enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Emily P. Freeman, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm so glad to be here.
So some of the work I'm most proud of is the work that Second City did collaborating with the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. And it was a program that looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa. I've talked about it a bunch on podcast. But one day, I'm sitting with my friend Heather Caruso, who I oversaw the program with. She's a behavioral scientist. And she says, you know what a terrible metaphor is? Climbing the corporate ladder. And she goes, I mean, what happens when you get to the top? What if we taught these kids in college that life is like a house, and sometimes you add rooms on and other times you move and reduce your rooms? And you also like this house metaphor very clearly, and not just for a career like we were talking about with kids in business school, but for your whole life.
That's right. You know, I do. First of all, I feel like I speak in metaphor a lot. So yeah. You're welcome. And I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you.
But I do think about if life were like a house, then every room holds a story. And there are some rooms that we walk into and we know immediately, this is my room and these are my people. And then we've got other rooms where we might crack the door, stick our head in, and we're like, absolutely not. Goodbye. Yep. But then there are those rooms where we maybe have belonged for a really long time. Maybe they've shaped us. Maybe they're rooms we fought to get into really hard. Maybe they were, you know, goals for us to walk into those rooms. But then something happens, a shift, a cultural change, a question, and we begin to wonder, is this still a room for me now? So what do we do when a room that we're in perhaps isn't a room for us anymore?
Yeah. I recall actually doing this with my therapist when we were doing EMDR, where literally she's like, you're in the hallway, like you just be in the hallway. And then flashing on rooms in the past. And then these, what would these new rooms look like? And it was because it was embodied, which is like, You'd think I just understand this because I work in a trade that is embodied training, but it's so different. It is so more impactful and meaningful because you are bringing all of you. And I think too, when I say embodied, I mean also spirit, and soul and purpose and meaning and all those other things that people don't necessarily. I don't know. I think things are changing a bit. I think that less and less people are cynical about those things because they're realizing it's all, in many ways, it's all we have.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all connected. And I think they're, you know, depending on our social location, our family of origin, kind of where we come from and what our own stories are, we all have our own narratives about what it means to be in a body, what it means to talk about spiritual things, what it means to live a life of reflection. But I think all those things matter when we think about the rooms that we're in. I mean, when we're in a room with someone, like a physical room, we may all be in the same room and we are all having perhaps in some ways a shared experience, but we're not having the same experience. Our experience depends on the stories that we bring with us that are already happening when we walk into the room. So I think when we start questioning spaces that we're in, you know, I work a lot with people in decision-making and discernment. And so the most difficult questions that people come to me with when we're in conversation is when they're questioning a room that they're in, that they've loved, that they've been part of, and they're starting to question their belonging there. It's the rooms that are tied to our identity. And so those questions that we have are formed by the ways we've been formed before we even entered that room. And so sometimes that can keep us from questioning whether or not we might want to enter a hallway or enter a different room, is because what does this say about me as a person and what will I have left if I walk out?
So we just opened our new our first theater in New York, in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, and it's lovely and great. My friend Dolly Chug, who's a behavioral scientist at NYU, sent me a note this morning, email, and she's like, I'm off to my first 5-day intensive that she's doing. And we were going back and forth. And I'm like, so what are you picking up on? She's like, it's the unlearning that we're doing at the beginning. And you write in the book, quote, most of my training has been less about learning how to listen and more about unlearning all the toxic ways we usually listen, to advise, to one up, to help. Talk more about that.
I work as a spiritual director, and all that means is that I have the privilege and honor of sitting with people as they show up in whatever way they are showing up, and discern how God might be moving in and around them, how spirit might be moving in and around them, and what that has to do with their actual life. And people sometimes come in and they're like, I don't know what to talk about, or what, you know, what's, they're looking for permission to talk about ridiculous things. And so as a listener, you know, as someone who has a front row seat to the life and potentially the soul of someone else, man, that's a high privilege, a high honor, and a high responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so much of the work that I've done as a trained listener is learning how to, learning all the ways that my own stuff shows up in the room. Because guess what? I'm not a conduit. I'm not a vacuum. I have my own stories that show up. And knowing those and being aware of those and noticing them, but not letting it drive the car, not letting it kind of take over. So, but that's a lot. There's a lot happening in your head, right? When you're listening, is you're responding to the person. You might get a little bored. You might, you know, something triggers in me that reminds me of something in my own life, but it's a constant redirection to this human soul in front of me who has a story all their own, who might be discovering something. And one of the things that we learn in our training is never steal someone's epiphany. And that might mean that I'm holding space for someone for a couple of years. And I could have on day one said, oh, here's what's going on. Here's what's happening. And here's what you need to do. That's not my job. That's their job. And part of them becoming who they are is them coming to that epiphany on their own. And that takes a lot of patience and discipline. And I don't always get it right, but that's a lot of what I have found to be so important in this unlearning listening work that I do.
So here's a wormhole we're going to go down. When you were talking, I was like, oh, that's one of the things that you're doing is taking a beat. So this idea of that, and I recall when we first started doing the work at the University of Chicago, we were very focused on, can we work with these communities where someone could take a beat before pulling a gun, was some of the conversation. I wrote my thesis on Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation. And not many people know that and a guy named John Cullen Holmes coined the term beat generation. They get the jazz implication, but it also meant beatific. Mm-hmm. Those were the things that he and Kerouac were talking about. And you actually write in the book, quote, your family script consists of particular beats. And I'm just thinking, oh, this is so interesting, because we are talking about scripted moments. We are talking about unscripted moments. We are talking about beats. And I think in all those ways, whether it's a beat as a pause, whether it's beat as in beatific, or that we use the term beat in comedy and like, oh yeah, you take a beat before this to get the laugh. And it's like, oh no, all connected again.
All connected again. Everything is connected. When I think about that question of I'm in a space, I'm making a big decision about, and listen, making decisions and being a discerning person, unfortunately, this is something we cannot graduate from, retire from, delegate. Like being a person means we're going to be making decisions our whole lives, and taking a beat is such a part of that. And I would say what happens in the beat that you take, man, that's going to decide the direction that you go, even just the smallest bit. And so I find that pause, that sacred pause, what could be a sacred pause, it may last for a moment. Or you might actually live a lot of your life in the sacred pause, what I would call the hallway, the space between the space, this liminal space where maybe a lot is happening, where it looks like nothing is happening. And what do we do in those spaces when we don't know what to do? I think that's something that we can be afraid of. But I find a lot of the juiciness in the discomfort of it. That's where the good things happen.
Sure.
And so that's kind of that hallway space, to continue with the metaphor, is, you know, the goal in life is not to find all the right rooms and to shut the door and paint the walls and we've found our space forever. No, there's a healthy human rhythm that we are all going to be embodying, whether we like it or not. So what if we moved with that rhythm and got curious about our own lives? Whether it's a space that we feel really comfortable in that we're questioning, or spaces that we might be entering that we're curious about.
Yeah. And you talk about this in the book, that certain people, less privileged people, are forced to recognize things that are going on in the room because it's life or death for them.
That's right.
The other thing, people who are very good at that are comedians, because they are observing for material. I went to I joined the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. And I went to my first meeting, and I was the only one without a suit. And so people would come to me like, are you the Second City guy? I'm like, how do you know? I was like, because you're not wearing a suit. And then they say, what are you doing here? I go, gathering material. And I'm not really, but I kind of am. So I'm always curious about this idea of the intentionality of waiting, the intentionality of stepping aside, and having a great amount of compassion for people who don't know when to move, because a lot of these, I'm a pretty good quitter, and we live in a culture that does not like quitting.
Yeah.
But we know that the culture's like that. The ridiculous thing is we quit all the time. We just find different names for it when it wants to be positive.
Right, sure. Which is, I mean, what a gift that we can do that. I think it's interesting you say that word quit, because so many people, we have our own narratives about what it means to leave and what it means to stay. Yep. And some of us, you know, like the scripts that we follow, maybe in our own family, our own vocation, whatever it is, it's a celebrated thing to be someone who's quick on your feet and, you know, is able to pivot quickly and do that. Whereas in another family or another script or another culture, that might be like, oh, you can't commit to anything. Like it's a whole different story, even if the exact same thing happened. So being aware of our own scripts that we have personally about quitting, staying, leaving, is often kind of the first movement or the first step when we're trying to discern what to do next.
Talk to us about and why the Japanese railway system shows up in your book.
Right. Well, the Japanese railway system is such an interesting study. And so it is, they've developed a system called pointing and calling. And if you've read James Clear's book, Atomic Habits, he talks about this in his book, as a process of developing habits that stick. But I got really interested about this concept. And really, essentially, it's so simple. Basically, what they've done is they've established the system of safety, where the railway workers, they literally just see what's happening as a part of their jurisdiction of what they watch. They point to it and they call it out loud. Speed of the train is this. They'll say it out loud. The signal is green. They'll point to the signal that's green and they'll say, signal is green. And they'll do this about various aspects of the train, when it comes into the station, when it leaves the station. And in some ways, it kind of mirrors what you might expect like a toddler to do as they're like playing on the floor, like ball and yellow and dog play. But what they have found, and the studies have shown, that this has reduced workplace errors by 85%. That this system of just literally paying attention and pointing and calling has helped to make this railway system safer. And so much like James Clear did for habits, I'm sort of applying that to our inner life and to these situations where we are questioning spaces that we're in. What might it look like if we were to point and call about the rooms of our life to say, here's what's true right now. Here are the spaces in my life, the committees I'm on, the relationships I'm in, the communities I'm a part of, and here's what's true about them, good, bad, and ugly. And just in a way, to keep with the metaphor, what might it look like to turn on the lights in those rooms? What's really happening? Because all of us have those places that we're committed to, and perhaps we have recognized that there are things that we're starting to question, but we don't know what to do with those questions, so therefore we just ignore them. but they're still there, and they'll creep in whether we like it or not. And so pointing and calling is sort of a way that we can maybe non-judgmentally begin to take stock of what's actually happening here. And I don't have to do anything about it. I can just notice it and name it, point to it, and mm-hmm. call it out loud.
We have an exercise that we teach a lot. A lot of companies want us to come in to make their people more agile, more creative. And so we have an exercise called point and untell. And we make people partner up, walk around the space, or we can do it virtually. And your job is to simply point at an object and say what it's not. So you just, if it's a cat, you can't say cat. And it is hard for people.
Yeah, I bet.
Right? But it's the other side of what you're talking about. Like there is absolutely the need to, in for a certain part of this, to claim it, to know it. And then there's that other part when you're ready to sort of venture in the unknown, where you then have to, it's again, a kind of unlearning of, well, it could be a purple, sunfish, that it's not. I just thought that was interesting, and it goes back to this idea of when do we need our scripts and when are we improvising? And life does feel a little bit like we're kind of always going to be sort of playing with those two things, because you can't even walk in the world without having some scripts. We go mad,
yeah,
given all the things that are going on, and we don't know what's going to happen next. Never. So we need that other training. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we try to do one without the other. But I read one of the scientists I was talking to recently said that Americans are the least dialectical, that they have the hardest time holding two opposite ideas in their head at the same time.
Man,
you're laughing.
We love ourselves, the Americans.
We're terrible.
Look at us. We're so complex and nuanced.
Oh God, we're not. We're terrible.
We're the worst.
So you said you have a friend who reads the last page of every novel to ensure it ends well, and if not, she doesn't read the book at all.
Right. Respect, right?
I don't know what to do with that.
Well, I mean, and it's interesting when she told me that, I was like, that can't be real, but it was pretty, yeah. It played out. I mean, it was pretty consistent. I don't even like to read the jackets of a book to see what I want to be surprised so much that I don't even like to read necessarily what's about. But then later I learned that she actually was, when she was in the second grade, she went on a field trip to a space shuttle, liftoff, and it was so exciting, and the whole class went, and they were standing around, and it was in the 80s, and as it turns out, that was the Challenger takeoff, and so she, as a second grader, felt that cold air in that January morning. She, as a second grader, watched that space shuttle take off with Krista McAuliffe, who was the teacher. We all knew the teacher. Yeah. We might not have remembered some of the other names, but we all knew the teacher. She saw that take off and that dark blue sky that we've seen, probably played on TV on the anniversaries over and over again. She saw it in real life. And yeah. So when you know that that was part of her story that formed how she sees the world, now it makes a little bit more sense why she might want to see, if things that she's going to opt into, like a novel or a movie, she wants to make sure that thing's going to end well, because in real life, there are too many unknowns, that we're going to enter, that we're going to get anyway. So how can I maybe establish some safety, some boundaries for myself? And I think that's an important thing to pay attention to, is we all have those things, right? We all have things like that that are informing how we walk into rooms.
Are you familiar with Annie Duke, her book Quit?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's terrific, right? I wrote down a quote from it. Annie and I are pals, but she writes in the book, quote, "Despite the way grit and quit have been pitted against each other, they are actually two sides of the exact same decision."
Mm, yeah.
So this is the other thing that we're kind of talking about. And What I'd like to jump into, because it is the central story of the book, is you making the decision to leave your church. I mean, this isn't an overnight decision by any stretch.
No, it wasn't at all. You know, part of my own family of origin, I grew up going to church. I mean, that was just part of what we did. And, you know, when I got married and my husband worked in a church for many years, and he no longer, you know, 15 years ago, he no longer works in a church, but we were a part of one. And it was a big part of our, not just our, you know, our faith expression, but it was also a big part of our community. It's where we offered our time. It's where we gave our money. It's, you know, it was just part of our community that we believed in. But like so many people in 2020, some of the questions that we had been carrying for a long time, just about this particular space we were in, started to, you know, we had room to consider them more than we did maybe in the years before. And that was something about those years. I think a lot of us did that in a lot of areas of our life where everything screeched to a halt. And here we were, we didn't have to maybe rush forward and do all the things we had been doing. And so some of those questions caught up to us. And that's kind of what happened with us, along with other things happening in our family and just kind of culturally. And that's when we decided slow and over time that, you know, I think that perhaps this is not the room for us anymore. And the reason, as you said, why it was slow is because so much of that room for us, that sanctuary, literal sanctuary, but also just the, you know, the ideological room with the people and the community, in that faith space, it was so much a part of who we were. I mean, we helped to shape this community. We were grateful for this community. And in many ways, I'll tell you, 4 years later, a lot of those people are still a part of our lives. We've been able to maintain those friendships. But anytime you're questioning a space that you are deeply embedded in, it's like the more embedded in that space you are, the longer it takes to discern, can I really walk away from this space? And what's at stake if I do? But also, what's at stake if I don't? And those are some of the questions we had to ask ourselves.
I don't think you use the term regret in the book. Are there regrets you have with regard to not leaving earlier, not doing differently?
I have a lot of regrets. And I think that probably much like you said, people change the word quit to something more positive. Yeah. I probably do that with regret. You know, I think in terms of, well, upon reflection, you know, perhaps I could have blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I think that, you know, when I look back, I'm like, wow, we could have done that 10 years before. Like we could have, there were things about it that we were just sort of, speaking of turning on the light, maybe we were leaving the candle lit, but that left a lot of corners that were shadowed. And when we finally had the time and the wherewithal to turn on some lights, we realized like, yeah, this just probably isn't the space for us anymore. But yeah, I would say that while I don't love the word regret, I don't think it's a bad word. I think it's just part of being a person. It's part of, and we have to dig down deep and find compassion for ourselves, right? When we recognize like, oh, I wish I would have done that differently, but I didn't know then what I know now. And so therefore I can come alongside myself and be my own friend and say, yeah, I wish I would have known, acted. I wish I would have had the courage to do a certain thing then, but I have it now and I can celebrate that.
Yeah, Dan Pink's last book is all about that. It's in the way Annie is trying to reclaim quit, he's trying to reclaim regret as being a very useful feeling with regard to sometimes when you're future casting, am I going to be regretful of this? And the things we mostly regret are not things we did. They are the inactions. So those, again, so that also makes sense. But there's all those kinds of reasons. And the thing is, we just can't hold on to it. You know, what we teach in our work is you to improvise successfully with someone else. So you have no script. You have to be fiercely in the moment. You cannot linger in the past and you cannot daydream in an extended future. Right. All you have is the person across from you and your job is to save them and their job is to save you. And when everyone is playing with those norms and those agreements and understands it, great things happen and very funny things happen. Surprising things happen. But usually when things go wrong is when we're not doing one of those things. The past, we're in the future, we're not taking care of the other person, they're not taking care of us. And that, I think that tends to be a true metaphor for all of this.
Oh, absolutely, it does. It makes me think of this, when we think of endings, when we think of ending something or closure to something, closure, listen, can we, you say Dan Pink is reimagining regret and Annie Duke is quit. I would like to take on closure. I just think that this is, we imagine, I mean, speaking of like, you know, thinking about creative, like a sitcom, for example, we all want all of our endings to be the series finale of our favorite sitcom. Yeah. We want them to turn in their apartment keys. We want them to slowly close the door and the lights go dim and the theme song plays and everybody's satisfied. And when you get endings like that, listen, toast to them. Yeah. Give the high fives. I mean, embrace them, but they just aren't going to happen very... That's the exception. It's not the norm. And yeah. I think one reason that keeps us in rooms too long is we're waiting for everything to line up. We're waiting for what I call readiness and timeliness to align perfectly. It's like, well, I'm ready and it's time. But those are our retirements. Those are our graduations, our weddings. Those are our anticipated endings that we plan for and circle on the calendar. And we want all our endings to be that way. But instead, what we get is, I'm so ready to go, but it's not time because I signed an NDA, or I'm contractually mm-hmm. obligated to be here, or I have a mortgage, or my mother is sick and I can't make this decision right now, but I'm so ready to be done with this, but it's not yet time. Or the opposite is true, where I am not ready at all, but guess what? It's time. That's the Saturday Night Live, example mm-hmm. of, we don't go on because it's ready. We go on because it's 11:30 on a Saturday night. Every person on that team would say, we're not ready. It's not ready, yes, but it's time. Creatively, we all know what it feels like to not be ready, but the book is due, or the script is, it just has to be finished. We live that all the time. But when it comes to endings that we have to decide, do I decide to leave this room or not? We are looking for our barometers, often our readiness and timeliness. Where am I on that spectrum? And man, they rarely, if ever, line up. And so that's when our tools of discernment, we got to dig deep and find, okay, what are decisions that I've made in the past? Those are the best indicators of decisions I'm going to make in the future. Who is coming with me? Who can I count on? What are some arrows that are maybe pointing me in a direction? Maybe not, I don't know where I'm going to end up, but I might know like the next right thing I can do. What are some of those things? And that's the best we can do. Readiness, timeliness, like that's not our... We may not be able to depend on those the way we, in our minds, have sort of been trained to do.
I think one of the greatest misunderstandings about creativity is people don't understand that very, very creative people, if they don't have them around them, they create constraints. You cannot, it's maybe an empty stage, but it is a stage. It is so many feet long by so many feet wide. It's that deep. I know that when we're creating a review at Second City, like, we have 12 weeks, but like, could we stretch it to 13? Probably, but let's just say we have 12 weeks. And in that time we are going to do this work, and there's lots of experimentation and other things, but there's also, and so I think when you're talking about this for as we live our lives, is recognizing anything could happen and anything will happen. And then we need to just know, do we have, and you use this term, what's our guidepost?
Yeah.
So if we have some sense of like, well, this is how I ethically believe, this is the thing, these are the things that are important to me. That's the toolbox. The toolbox isn't a bunch of other stuff. It's not calendars and other things. It is these things that we understand about ourselves, or we think we understand. And by the way, those change.
By the way, they change, and they are going to be different than someone else's. And I think naming and knowing our own core values is so deeply important. I mean, core values, it's such a, like, it sounds like a corporate term, like we do this mm-hmm. in business class. But man, I think personal core values, be able to name those, even if they're just one word, are so important, because if not, we run the danger of becoming highly successful inside someone else's life. It happens all the time, where we're measuring our standard of success is based on something that someone else or something else has said is successful, and we're miserable because we have adopted someone else's core values.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but can we talk about fires?
I would love to.
All right. Do you want to hear about my fire story first?
Yes, please.
Okay. So I wrote this book, Yes And, did really well, and I was going through a terrible midlife crisis at Second City, and I decided to quit. And luckily, the owner at the time was like, why don't you stick around for a year to see if you can build a bridge in or build a bridge out? And I'm like, great, because I had nowhere to go. The kids were young. It was just, I didn't know what I was going to do. So I leave to go to Michigan on vacation, and I'm pumping gas in my car, and one of my coworkers, Nate, texts me, your office is on fire. And I work at Second City, so I'm assuming it's a bit. And it is not.
It's not a bit.
I just moved into this new office. It was everything I had collected over, you know, what is this, like 25 years of working at Second City. And there was a upscale Mexican restaurant right below my office, grease fire, went straight up. The firefighters saved Second City, like the stages, but yeah. I maybe have like 6 charred things left from that office.
Oh, wow.
The gift that ended up being for someone who needed to reinvent who they were. I was forced out of an office. I was forced to not be in my comfort zone. I got a call from Adam Grant to say, hey, would you meet with my friend, Ai-Jen Poo, who I didn't really know, but I couldn't say no. I go to this lunch. This is one of the most important people in my world. She's the executive director of Caring Across Generations, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, a MacArthur Genius grantee. We created an improvisation for caregivers program because of her, which also changed my life. So I can't look at this fire. Like, yes, there was terrible things about the fire. Luckily, no one died. But I can't not see the opportunity that came from it. You have some fire stories.
I'm telling you, fire is an image, is a grounding metaphor for me, much like the house, which is ironic, a house and a fire.
Yeah, right.
And they come together. I think about it in several different ways. One is in terms of a controlled burn. My husband, John, and I were in Florida, and I'd never seen a controlled burn up close. Yeah. I'd heard of them, but we were on an interstate in Florida one winter day, and we were like, oh, there's fire truck. Like, they're doing a thing there. Like, it was clear it was under control. But let me tell you what, that fire was hot. We rode by on the interstate. And I remember, I mean, it was like, I instinctively rolled my window down because I felt like, I just feel like I could feel the heat. And sure enough, it opened my pores from the interstate. That's how hot this fire was. But watching that, you know, it was still hot and it was still destructive, but it was destructive within boundaries. And so that stayed with me. And then in contrast to that, when I was in fifth grade, I lived in Bettendorf, Iowa, and across the street from us in the middle of the night, a house caught on fire. And luckily, no one died. No one was really hurt badly. But it's a memory that's really seared in my mind, no pun intended, because I was young, and I remember the smell. I remember the sounds. And this house, it did not burn all the way to the ground. Often we say, well, the house burned down. Well, no, the house didn't burn down. The house burned from the inside out. Cool. And if you passed it on the outside, it was a standing house. But if you looked closely, you see there was darkness in the windows. And we later learned that one of the things that really caused the fire to go up in flames the most was because the people in the house, some people climbed out windows and went out that way, but one person went out the front door. And when they opened that front door, it offered them safety. But what it did was the oxygen rushed into the house, and the house went up in flames even faster. And it was ironic to think about the very thing that saved that person was the thing that sent that house up in flames. Mm. And so when I think about these rooms and spaces of our lives that we're discerning, is this a space for me or not? Sometimes what you leave behind, it's like ash. It's like nothing, you know, you feel like, wow, me doing this is going to cause this thing to fall apart. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. But in any case, it's sometimes true in our hearts. But I think that sometimes we want our leaving to be more like a controlled burn. Like, this is under control. It might be destructive a little bit, but it's going to be okay. But then sometimes it's complete devastation. And sometimes we're the ones that are on fire, and we look like everything's fine on the outside, but on the inside, things have burned from the inside out. But I really do believe in the principle. It's a verse that says that beauty will come from ashes. But I have to think about that a little bit, because I also have to confess that for beauty to come from ashes, something has to burn. And so it sounds to me like your story was such a beautiful example of that, that beauty did come from ashes, but something had to burn.
Yeah, something had to burn. I mean, this is the Buddhists kind of have this on us, right? Where it's like, there is no joy without suffering. There's no suffering without joy. Mm-hmm. Like, there's going to be the fire. And then also, I think the reason it hits us is because it is so, it's ingrained in our beings as humans. This is when human beings learned fire. And that also meant warmth. That meant cooked food. But it was always dangerous.
Yeah, it was still hot. That's right.
Yeah, still really, really hot. All right. We always end the podcast with the yes and story. I think you're full of them. I'm curious what yours is going to be.
Oh, good. Well, so the yes and. So sometime a time when I thought I would say no, but I ended up saying yes and. Mm-hmm. It's funny. So back in 2016, I thought I was going to, I had this great idea for a book about decision making, and I pitched it to my editor and I was like, here's what I want to do. And she was like, I mean, basically the pat on the head, like, that's cute. It's not ready yet. Or maybe keep thinking. And that was sort of my, like, in my head, I was like, okay, that's not happening. So I sort of closed the door on writing this book about decision making discernment, but it wouldn't leave me alone, as these things often go. And so I decided to start a podcast. I'm like, because it was coming to me like, in episodes, in a way, like these ideas, just like these like 10-minute things. If only there was a medium that you could talk your ideas out and you could do them 10 to 15 minutes at a time. Oh, there is. It's called podcasting. So I started a podcast called The Next Right Thing back in 2017. And I was like, okay, I found it. That's it. Period. The end. Like it is a podcast. That is the form this idea wanted to take. The end. And then about 6 months into it, my editor calls me up and she's like, hey, so guess what? You've been writing your next book. And my instinct was, no, I haven't. No, I've got a pot. It's a podcast. Like, it's not a book. It's a podcast. This is the creative form it wants to take, period, the end. Like, this is the limitation I've given myself. So when she said that, my instinct was really like a no, like, no, I'm doing this because you said no to the book. So I'm doing this. But upon reflection, as I sat with it and thought about it, I thought, well, okay, if it were a book, I thought, you know, well, yes. And I'm going to make it easy. I'm just going to take what I've been doing in the podcast and I'm going to turn all those episodes into chapters for the book. And if they say no to that, then I'm not doing it. But they didn't say no. They said yes. So now there's a podcast and a book called The Next Right Thing. But that was it was so funny when I look back. I'm like, Emily, she was handing this to you on a platter. You could have just like this could have been the thing, you know, like, and you could have not fought it. But my instinct was like, no, absolutely not. That's not what this is. So I'm glad I reconsidered.
I love it. The book is called How to Walk Into a Room, The Art of Knowing When to Stay and When to Walk Away. Emily P. Freeman, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.